There you go. Hey, everybody, Jimmy Dean, alcoholic.
I got them lined up for you.
In my part of the world, Dallas, Texas, old-timers say, give a sobriety date. If you don't give one, they might think you don't have one. And so mine is August the 25th of 1997, and I'm thankful for that. And I'm glad to be here. I commend all of you. I didn't think we'd see more than 30 or 40 people after the dinner break, frankly. And thank you. You did a good job. You said that's the first time you've ever done it, right?
Well, at the assembly, yeah.
There you go. Well, depending on the committee, it might be the last time you ever did. You said love and tolerance, though, right? You were talking about love and tolerance. No, we're good. We're good. The kiss of death is when somebody gets up here and says, well, I don't know who this is, but here's his name and where he's from. So I'm glad we didn't do that. I'm glad to be in a service meeting in AA, my area, Area 65, Northeast Texas, having an assembly. It's an off-year assembly for us. We're an odd panel, which shouldn't surprise anybody. And so they've had a set of service workshops and stuff this weekend. Some of the guys I sponsor and certainly other people I know have been over there. And so I'm thankful and grateful to have a seat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, in any room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I do what I think we're asked to do, which is tell you in a general way what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like now, and certainly throw in a little bit of my third legacy experience, how that's been, I think, an important component of my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll know that I'm cleverly disguised as a functioning member of society because of the 12 steps of AA. And I want to thank Tracy. You're well served. You've been well served. That's probably not news to any of you. You know, one of the things I learned in bodies just like this, I went to my first area assembly when I had 4 months of sobriety. I had no idea where I was going. The way I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 32 years old. I was dying of alcoholism. And so that sponsor that I met across the picnic table before I learned how to become a member of my first home group, before I took my last drink, right, the long, hot summer of 1997, by the time I got sober, I listened to the direction that he gave me. I mean, we can call it suggestion if we're more comfortable with that, but it was direction. And when he asked me to call him every morning at 7:30, I called him every morning at 7:30, and we went to 3 AA meetings a week together, and we ate a lot of Lenner dinner, breakfast, brunch, Brenner pie, cake, coffee. He spent a lot of windshield time with me. I struggled with the spiritual part of the program. And Greg, big tall guy, looks like Larry Bird, he'd look over at me and he'd go, there is no spiritual part. And I'd be a little bit taken aback, thinking that, you know, one of the AA lightning bolts was going to come down and strike him in the car, and he'd clarify what he said for the new guy. He'd say, it's the only thing. That's all we got. That's all we got. He said, we have a spiritual program of action. So in January of 1998, when I got, at 4 months of sobriety, some direction on a Friday afternoon from my sponsor, he said, I want you to go to Fort Worth to the Green Oaks Inn. You need to be there by 7:15 a.m. tomorrow morning. You introduce yourself to a woman named Cheryl Howe, and Cheryl will tell you what to do. And I didn't say, how much will it cost me? I didn't say, oh, my gosh, that's awfully early in the morning. And it wasn't because we didn't have the opportunity to have dialogue with one another. I don't want anybody to think the two men that I've called sponsors since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, both strong, formidable members of AA, not a single one, neither one of those guys ever put a finger in my chest. Never. They put a lot of arms around my shoulder. And if you're sitting in this assembly at 8:15 to listen to some goon from Dallas, Texas tell his story, I will safely assume that arms have been around your shoulder as well. And we do it because there's a debt, right? There's a debt. So even in my infancy in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that Greg had spent an awful lot of time with me. And I knew that I had tried his patience time and time again to discuss with him how that element of surrender to a power greater than myself seemed to be a bitter pill to swallow. And he had given me very simple things to do. And I thought, I can't say no. And so I went over and I met Cheryl. She's in the big meeting now. She's been up there for quite a while. And the first thing Cheryl said when I introduced myself to her was, "Can you write?" I said, "I'm a college graduate." She said, "Again, I will pose the question. Can you write?" I said, "Well, yes, I can." So they put me on the registration table, which, by the way, is the bomb. Being a greeter in a home group and being a registration guy at an area assembly or gal at an area assembly, that's the bomb. And so I met my new peers, and all I knew at 4 months of sobriety was I believed everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous had a home group. I just knew you did. And so you came up and you said, "I'm Susie M., and I'm the DCM for district in, over here. It'd be 12A. And I'd go, "Susie, what's your home group?" And Susie'd say, no, this is a service meeting." She's polite, nice, kind. She said, "No, on that badge, you need to fill out Susie, DCM. That's my service position." I'd go, "Susie, what's your home group?" And finally, after a couple of minutes, Susie looked at the line that was gathering behind me, you know, there, and she felt sorry for me. And so she just grabbed the Sharpie and the card, and she filled out her own badge and shoved it in the sleeve, went on about her business. Somebody else came up and said, "I'm the chair of public information, panel 49. And I'd go, "Oh, Bob, what's your home group?" And we'd have 2 or 3 minute conversation, me and Bob would have to grab the Sharpie and the card and fill out his badge. And this old kind of grizzly looking guy comes up behind and comes up and he says, "My name's Jim T. I'm past delegate, panel 45. And I said, "Oh gosh, Jim, what's your home group?" He said, "This is a service meeting. And in a service meeting, I need to be identified by my service position, my role in the assembly. My role in the assembly is past delegate, panel 45. And I looked up Jim and I said, "My gosh, Jim, if you're past, nobody cares." So I made it through the morning when an old guy, and you got one in, more than one probably over here, but in Dallas, Texas, in Southwest region, we had an old trustee at large U.S., past delegate for Northeast Texas, named David A. And David talked all over. If you've been sober 30 years more than AA, you heard David talk. And so David shoot out of the assembly room. You know, they had the doors closed. Wasn't anything happening over on registration. And every now and then I'd hear somebody kind of squeal or holler or something back there. And I thought, "What? I wonder what they're doing in there." And David popped out when he was coming back to the men's room or whatever. I said, "What's going on in there?" And he said, "We're voting on how to vote." And I thought, okay. Then about, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes later, and broke out of there again. Here he comes back, and I said, "Oh my gosh, I hear more noises than I heard before. What's going on now?" And he said, "Oh my gosh, we've moved on. We're in heady wine, heady subjects now." I said, "What is it?" He said, "We're pole vaulting over mouse turds." But he came out after the lunch break, and he taught me, out of the old Brown service manual, he taught me about the panel numbers, what the panel numbers meant. And he talked to me in very simple terms, easy to understand, why in everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's always some collective experience. There's the newer segment and the older segment, the even panels and the odd panels. And David always liked to give a little bit of history, and so he talked just a little bit about panel one. His grand sponsor had been the Panel 1 delegate from Northeast Texas, and he talked about Panel 1, and then I got a little bit of David's story, and, you know, he wove service into that recovery story, and he talked about what it had meant in his recovery. And I was from three legacy AA members, right? They didn't make a big deal out of it. I never needed a service sponsor. I mean, I had a sponsor who understood and applied the concepts and kind of, you know, helped me through some of that. So I don't know that I ever actively sought a service position. I was just told to stand and see what happened. And here we are 26 years later, and I've stood. And I really was glad we had that presentation on the principle of rotation, because rotation is a spiritual principle in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you, at 32 years of age, I wanted it to stop, right? I wanted it to stop. And that struggle, right, with a power, any power, you know, why is it that the harder that I pushed at it, you know, the harder it smacked me back? When it had turned, right? I drank for 17 years. I drank with gusto. I drank with wild abandon. I loved to drink. I loved it. I didn't even know I had alcoholism when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought, you know, all those things that had happened early on in my life, right? There were those things. I was in a good home. I mean, it changed, right? But it was always a good home. I mean, certainly I've sponsored enough men. I was amazingly blessed. My mother was a Southern girl. She from Metairie, Louisiana, gone to Dallas to go to school. Her family had been down there for a couple of hundred years. That didn't send anything big for Georgia, but I can tell you, in Texas, that's a long, long time. Her family couldn't believe she'd come to Texas for higher education, and there she was, right? She met my dad, and they got together right after she graduated from college. And they did things the way that I guess people who were somewhat structured did in the late 50s and early 60s. They actually engaged to be married and stayed engaged for a whole year. And then they got married and stayed married for a whole year. And then they had me. And so they followed, you know, like I guess I would say a pattern that was in an era of an age. There weren't any breaking glass in that house. There weren't any squealing tires in the driveway. There weren't any loud voices. My father was a businessman, had a company to run. They shot seismic. The only trauma that I can remember is my dad would go off on these 2 and 3 day trips, and I hated it when my dad left the house. I hated it. I was a little 3 or 4 year old boy. We lived in a big old house in a historic district in Dallas. You got houses like it all over the state of Georgia. If you ever seen reruns of the Munsters on television, you've seen that big old house. Brown brick, green tile roof. He'd leave and there'd be rounds of the clock. My mother called it rounds of the clock. I'd always go, and when is he coming back? When's he coming back? She'd go, one more round of the clock. And I couldn't figure out if we'd gone one round or two rounds. And, you know, it's kind of like when one of the guys I sponsor, they were having, I don't have any children, but my sponsor has four, and they were having a whole lot of trouble getting their first child to go to bed at night. And so my sponsor and this, my guy and I were standing around after an AA meeting one night. And I mean, it was really causing a lot of trouble with his wife, who's not in any program, and him and the new kid and all this other kind of stuff. And my sponsor said, just close the drapes and tell them it's nighttime. They won't know any different. And it worked, right? So my mother used rounds of the clock. When my dad came back home, he made it a big deal, right? It was a big deal. He'd only been gone 2 or 3 days. We had two front doors in that big old house, and he'd slam that first front door as hard as he possibly could, and he had a mark. He'd stand on a mark in the middle of those two doors and holler at the top of his lungs, home! I'm home, I'm home, and just bellow through that old tomb of a house. You'd be in that playroom on the third floor or out in the corner, and it sounded like he was right next to you. Sometimes I'd see if I could wait him out, see what he might do if he didn't respond immediately. He'd go back outside, he'd slam that front door louder, and he'd yell, right? He wanted you to come. I don't know how long you could hold out, 3 or 4 years old. I'd bound on those stairs 2 at a time. He always had a jacket. He'd say, Jimbo, reach in a pocket. I'd have to get in one of these side pockets on the outside of that coat. I'd find whatever the prize happened to be. If he'd really missed me bad, he'd make me get in his lap and get in this inside pocket, right? I get a Flint Rock or Hot Wheels car or Arrowhead. He'd been out in the wilds of New Mexico, and he'd describe the bluffs around Alamogordo, New Mexico. He made it sound so magic, right? And then I went to Alamogordo, New Mexico, grown, drunk and sober, and it's not very magic. But anyway, we had that house. We had a good home, right? Then, I don't know, one day he stopped off at somebody else's house and never came back. It happens. It happens. I don't know if we had any deep conversations about any of that, little four-year-old boy. I know Mom was glad. In retrospect, my mother was a strong woman. She's independent, and she had her own resources. She took care of her child. We stayed in the same place. That's a gift. Nothing changed externally. And so within a year, she met another man. It was a big deal in her life. She was a Catholic, devout, went to church every day. So that was a huge thing. All I knew is the date was coming, right? I didn't know if it was animal, vegetable, mineral. I had no idea what date meant. And I stood out there on La Vista Drive and waited for it to show up. And it came in a yellow Ford Fairlane 500 convertible. I mean yellow. Had double glass packs on the back of it. He was 6'3", had lamb chop sideburns and curly black hair, had on black shirt, black pants, black belt, black pointy-toed boots. You can think about that. My father, the businessman, seismic dude, Exhibit A. The date, Billy Jack, Exhibit Z. Right? So I'm amazed and intrigued. My mother was too. Within the course of a few months, she had that first marriage annulled, and they got married. We made a family. He was a stockbroker. He didn't dress like one, but that's what he did for a living. And we rocked and rolled along, right? And I'll speed up this ancient history stuff to tell you that one year we got an opportunity to move to Lafayette, Louisiana, and my mother was from, again, the Deep South. In fact, she said coffee, it sounded like a 9-syllable word, right? And so we lived on the New Iberia Road, kind of in Lafayette, kind of not in Lafayette. I ran with a bunch of Cajun kids. We had a great time. I picked up a grandmother, my stepdad's mom, as part of that marriage. Lovely person. She flew down to Lafayette to bring me back to Dallas for the summer so my parents could go off and do the things that they wanted to do, and I could have a break, they could have a break. There weren't any laws about anything back then. My mother got on the plane with us that morning. She talked to her little boy. She told me about all the things they were going to do. She said, "No, you won't believe how quick the summer's going to pass. We'll all be back together in Lafayette." And we flew to Dallas. Next morning, I was upstairs in my grandmother's house. I heard people talking. The phone was ringing. I smelled coffee and breakfast. I went downstairs, hit the last tread on that step, and there were 30 or 40 people in that living room that morning. I thought, what in the world? My grandmother of now about 3 years, she looks at the little boy and she says, "We've got to go back to Lafayette. Your mother's had an accident. I was about to get up and get you. Get up, go upstairs and get you." We got on the next plane, took a couple of people with us, and we'd go to Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Lafayette, Louisiana. And it was a small old building then. It's gone now, the old building. And they'd deposit me in a waiting room towards the front of that hospital and walk down the hallway and go in a room. And then we didn't have any technology in 1973. I was 8. And so if you've ever been in an old government building, those old square ceiling tiles, acoustic, they've got those dots in the tiles, and I just count those dots just to pass the time, right? And every now and then I lose the number. If I lost the number, I look down the hallway, and I look down the hallway, and somebody come out of a room, and I think they're coming to get me. Because if I hold her hand or I whisper in her ear, I can fix it. I just knew that I could. Nobody talked. Only as an adult, really after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, did I realize they had absolutely nothing to say. I mean, there was just really nothing to say. They weren't bad people. They were just people who were absent any way to describe what was happening. They were just living in the moment. And so that's what we did for the next 7 or 8 days. And they sent a priest up the hall, and he sat down next to me and gave me a prayer card and said, think good thoughts about your mother. And that's why they let me know that she had passed away. Something or somebody had run her off the road right after she left us at the Lafayette Airport, and she didn't survive. Now, that certainly did not earn me a seat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But she was the most God-fearing person I'd ever known. She did get her cup filled in her building. And she believed it was important for her to impart to her only child what it meant for her to surrender to a power greater than herself. And I watched her do that. I watched her take those actions. And even though I was only a little boy, it was really burned into my consciousness. And what I learned from the experience that I just described to you was, don't you ever get too close to that power. Never. Don't ever let your guard down. It'll destroy you. And destroy the lives of people around you that love you unconditionally. I mean, I watched it in real time, or at least I thought I did. I had a real father that was living. He didn't make himself known. So we closed that house up in Lafayette. We came back to Dallas. And south of Fort Worth, there's a little town called Glen Rose. And we had a big ranch down there. And my stepdad, my dad, he went down on that ranch. I was living with his mom, my grandmother, and he'd call on the weekends, ask me how school was going. If I'd hooked up with my old friends, I'd hang up, and I'd think, you know, he should be here with us because he's my dad now, and I'm living with his mother. My grandmother was the youngest of 9 children. They all lived these incredibly long lives, at least 90. There were 5 girls in that family, and I'll swear to you, those 5 sisters talked to each other every day for 75 years. I'd eavesdrop on our conversations, and she'd say, he just needs time. His heart is broken because of the way she died. But that land will give him strength. From the time he was a little boy, that land has always given him strength. And so what we did is we left him on that land. And 11 months after my mother died, our house was full of people because my stepfather committed suicide in the living room of that ranch house, her only child. And at 9 years of age, I was angry because you didn't fix it. And that's an awkward situation. I mean, unfortunately, in my experience as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes that's what the jumping off place means. And I've certainly experienced that in AA. But I can tell you that to a man or woman, when they would part company with her, trying to give her some solace, trying to give her some comfort, they would say, you know, God doesn't give you more than what you could handle. And even though I was just a little kid, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, they have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. They're not going home with her, that big, huge house, every single light on, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and her crying herself to sleep on the middle of the living room floor. I mean, that's not right. So I spent the first 10 or 15 minutes in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, supposed to be about alcoholism, talking to you about stuff that happened long before 15, which is when I took my first drink. Because I absolutely believe my fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous should know that, it left to my own devices, I don't surrender to anything. And I absolutely believe the collective experience, the first 70-odd people that helped to write that book, when they said that the main object of said book was to help a guy like me solve my problem, find a power greater than myself that will solve my problem. It was a huge hurdle for me when I came. Lots of people pat their feet, intimidated, when the topic, subject matter in a weekend book study or a book study, a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we begin to talk about we agnostics, or we begin to talk about the third step. I watch it, and I can feel it. I have empathy and understanding because I'm that guy or that gal, right? I am that person. I'm the person who thought I could neatly postpone or evade, surrender to something. Doesn't matter what, in my experience, that it is. I call it God and have for a long, long time, but that was the antithesis of my plan when I finally found myself on the doorstep of AA. Now, 5 minutes of my drinking career of 17 years. So my real father was living. He was not interested. He had married a woman who had a daughter. That was where he was. He died when I was 19. He had a stroke. I found out about it just through neighborhood information, right? So I had this stepfather's mother, this grandmother, who my sponsor of the last 23 years continued to reinforce to me, thank goodness, that she was even remotely available to me. And she said, I love this boy and I loved his mother, and obviously my son loved them both. And she raised me. And every drunk in the room has at least one of those people that they drug with them when they came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The person that loves them unconditionally. She thought, if I just pay for that rent 6 months, get him out of that place, it'll change. If I just change the people that he's hanging out with, it'll be different. He says 3 months in Switzerland again is really good and will help him get his chakra in alignment. Let me just get him over to Switzerland to align his chakra and he'll be different. All of that stuff. I had 14 years of continuous sobriety when she left the earth at the age of 95, and we were current. She not one single time ever entered Alcoholics Anonymous. In other words, she didn't come to my cake every year. She had my sponsor's number in her cell phone. She knew his name and address. And she knew about VAA. She didn't care how many men I sponsored. She didn't care if I was the delegate, trustee. I mean, she didn't care about any of that. When I told her I'd pick her up for lunch at noon on Saturday and my car was in the driveway at 11:45, you got 100% credit for that. She knew. She knew that Alcoholics Anonymous had all of that. I made one of my first talks a little over your sobriety. World famous Town North group of Alcoholics Anonymous had a Sunday morning meeting, speaker meeting for 60 years. Somebody who wasn't a very savvy program chair, somehow somebody referred me, and I'm going over there to make a talk. So I was in regular communication with her by then, 14, 15 months of sobriety, through sponsor direction. And I said, I can't come over and take you to lunch today because I got to make a talk. She said, talk? Talk about what? I said, well, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we share our story. It's really the foundation of AA. It's called a speaker meeting, and you go over and you tell what you were like and what happened and what you're like today. And she said, good God, how much time do they give you for that? I said, well, the meetings last an hour, but really I think they said 50 or 55 minutes max. She said, make sure before you come down from there that you let them know I did not raise you to be alcoholic. I mean, it was not something that... But, you know, the keen alcoholic mind, I mean, my sponsor had to divine some of the things that I could not see as true. Not in a cruel way, but in an objective way. Isn't that why sponsorship is so extraordinarily effective? Because the sponsor is not emotionally vested in any of my stuff. And so when I would say stuff like when I was almost expelled from SMU and after my first semester on a full academic scholarship because I was plagiarizing. They don't like when you plagiarize, especially if they're paying your tuition. And my grandmother played bridge with a couple of women that were on the board of trustees, and she went in that admin building with me that day, and she basically told them that I was going to stay in the university. I mean, that's what happened. She called some favors, and I stayed in school, and after 5 years, I actually left with a degree. Now, I spent lots of years not driving within 5 or 10 miles of the campus, knowing that they were going to figure out they made an error. But, I didn't even say thank you when we walked out of that building that day. I didn't say thank you for that till after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You got a sense of entitlement, and you put alcoholism on top of that sense of entitlement, and you've got an untenable situation. There's no question about that. So not long after that, she quit playing cards over there at that club with those women. So years later, I come to AA. I'm having this casual conversation with my sponsor. It doesn't matter. I'm in my first few months of sobriety. I'm maybe still struggling in the second step. Maybe I'm on step, 3.1. And he's just asking me about this lack of a relationship. He wants to know, right? He wants to know about, he's getting towards causes and conditions because he's been in AA for a little while and he knows it's not about drinking. He knows that Alcoholics Anonymous is not about drinking. He's read ahead. And so I said, well, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And it was kind of ugly because, yeah, I really did. I was cheating, and I was trying to describe this SMU experience. And then I said something about her not playing cards anymore. And he said, ah, really? And I said, yeah. And he said, you know why that was? And I said, yeah, because, you know, she felt uncomfortable because she had had that interchange with those women that day, and they were on that board. And he said, no, that's not it. She was tired of looking down at her cards or looking down at her shoes every time your name came up around that card table. And she felt like, I'll just surrender to that, go somewhere else. I never saw it for that, but when I made direct amends, go figure, I got all that information. Isn't that interesting? So I took my first drink at 15. I was a freshman in high school, a year younger than everybody else because my birthday was in December, and I had these two friends. They were identical twins. Their dad was a podiatrist. Oh, my God. Nerds, are you kidding? Terrible. We had two cups of hot foam from a tapped-out keg at the hill at White Rock Lake. They were having a senior beer bust, and the nerds, freshman nerds, just went and hid and watched them have it. But there was a senior leader of that pack, and he was a worldly individual, and he knew I had resources. They wanted to avail themselves of my resources, and he gave me a list of three things that I needed to do, and he said, we will teach you how to have a good time. And I need to let you know they fulfilled that 1,000%. You had to be 18 back in the dark ages in order to drink legally in the state of Texas. They were quickly going to change that, but at that time, in the fall of 79, you needed to be 18. I don't know what you did in Georgia in order to magically become 18, but in Dallas, Texas, you went down on Greenville Avenue and you gave a nice little old woman $50 and she made you 18. The second thing you needed was a hardship driver's license. You could drive in the state of Texas at 15. I think you probably still can, but they give you some ID, like they rotate your head. They turn you upside down or inside out. I mean, it doesn't. They know you're seriously restricted, right? Way back then, I've been driving at the ranch forever. I went and took the test. I was proud that I passed the test, but they gave me a restriction. Manual, not computerized. They put a sticky tape on the back of the license that said, to and from school only. So I went to the senior leader of the pack. I was proud of the license. I said, but I can't drive at night. Now remember, I'm 15. I mean, I haven't been drunk yet. And I said, there's a restriction on that driver's license. Well, he's the worldly dude, right? He just flipped that license over and ripped the sticky tape off the back of the license. I mean, I was appalled. That's 45 years ago, and it still just makes me a little uncomfortable, right? I said, there's a seal on that. It came from Austin. You can't malign or defame that. It's an official document. He said, dude, they run your license 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. That cop's going to come back to the window. He's going to look at you, and he's going to say, Mr. Dean, you can't legally operate a motor vehicle on the streets of Dallas, Texas, late at night. You make sure you look that cop right in the eyes. And you say, officer, I had absolutely no idea there was a restriction on my driver's license. He's giving me data that's about to make my head explode, right? I said, if I did that, it'd be a lie. He said, if you tell a lie and they believe it, it's no longer a lie. Third and final thing I needed was a car to go with the license. I don't know how you got stuff you weren't supposed to have, but I went home through a fit. Had a brand new Firebird. Had 14 miles on it when I drove it off the lot. I went through the horseshoe at Woodrow the next day to let everybody know I'd arrived. Junior girl saw the car. She didn't see the license, but she saw the car. I wasn't in that building 2 minutes. She found me, gave me her address, said, pick me up 7 o'clock. We went to Papago Disco on Greenville Avenue in fall of 1979. Oh, my God, they were old in there, 25, 30 years old. It was terrible. I was 15. I looked like I was about 9. She was 17. She'd had a couple of growth spurts, but she still couldn't pass for legal. They had trays of amaretto sour circulating around that bar that night. You throw $1.50 up on the barmaid's tray and grab a drink. 150 people did it that night. I did it too. I swallowed that drink just as quick as I possibly could, like everybody else appeared to be doing. Oh, Amaretto wasn't going to be my liquor of choice, I'm going to tell you that. It's like cough medicine with ice cubes in it. Somebody said, get another one. I got another one. Another $1.50. Grab the drink. I don't know if it was in the second or the third swallow. It happened. Where had that been? Drinking for a guy like me, I can make tomorrow seem like it's a million years away, and there's lots of times I need tomorrow to be a million years away. I found something for the next 17 years that if I imbibe enough of it, it'll allow me to repaint yesterday and make yesterday look exactly the way that I always wanted it to look. In fact, I find that after I'm a member of a society such as this, we're so uncanny about the ability to not differentiate the true from the false that people that are around us that love us unconditionally, they begin to believe what I believe, which is blatantly false. And I can pull them into that where they're actually questioning, was I there or was I not even there? Next 10 or 12 years of alcoholic drinking, I would have told you I only paid $1.50 for each one of those, I don't know, 6 or 7 sweet drinks that I had that night, enough to brown out, black out, pass out, get sick. Somebody pulled me out of the men's room, $1.50 apiece. I got knee-walking drunk on $15. But we know I paid with bits and pieces of my character that night. I started giving away some of those tools for living that I'd been given from the time I was a little boy. Had no idea, first decade, last 6 or 7 years of my drinking, I knew, and I paid. And if you were still foolish enough to be close to me, you paid too. And in order for me to be okay with that, I'm getting drunk just to forget about the stuff the last time I got drunk. And when did it change, right? When did it change? So I got a couple of DWIs. I got a bunch of public intoxications. I have aggravated public intoxication. I'm still not sure I even understand exactly what that is. I got public intoxications inside bars. It's hard to get a public intox in a bar. I don't ever drink moderately. I don't ever drink for anything other than the effect produced by alcohol. I guess I'm fortunate in that most of what I imbibed, other than that Amarillo, I liked it. I love the glasses that it came in. I certainly loved it. I got a sense of ease and comfort just driving to the liquor store. I know what's at the liquor store. And all the, you know, attendant problems, abrasions, contusions, emergency rooms, hospital rooms, irregular heartbeats, broken arms, legs, bum, knee, head. It's just part of what, you know, we're just having a good time. When I got bonded out of jail for my second DWI, I didn't have two nickels to rub together, but I called my grandmother's lawyer, a family friend, told him she'd be glad to pay any bill he happened to present and needed to get downtown and get me out, and he did. I was still half drunk, three-quarter drunk when I got out of Lusteret that night. 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, a crazy man went to one of the nicest parts of my city and beat on an 80-year-old woman's door until she came downstairs. I hadn't seen my grandmother probably in a year because I hadn't needed anything, right? I hadn't written a bunch of hot checks that she had to pick up. I wrecked my car and needed another car. I hadn't needed anything. When she opened the door, I'll swear to you, she looked me square in the eyes and she couldn't recognize me. And that was not from substances other than alcohol. It was from drinking. It had changed me fundamentally. So she's trying to preserve what little dignity she may have left. She puts me in a side room to sleep it off, and after 2 or 3 hours, I start sobering up. We know after 17 years of drinking the way that I drink every day, all day, as much as possible, sobering up's a bad deal. She said, honey, I can't give you your keys because if you drive, you're going to kill yourself or somebody else. So I start tearing up her house. Pull a telephone cord out of the wall and tell her I'll strangle her with the cord if she doesn't give me my keys. And as it's happening, I know it's wrong, but I can't stop it. When did it change? And I'm coming to you. I'm coming to you. That second DWI, I was about to be revoked. 2 years of state jail, revocation of probation. Probation officer invited me into her office the week before Memorial Day. I sat down in front of her and she said, "Mr. Dean, I've already been to the courts. I'm going to have you arrested right here in the office." She was giddy about it. "I'm going to ask you if you think you'd suffer from the disease of alcoholism." I said, "I think drinking may have a little problem, And on that flimsy read, I got to an outpatient treatment facility within 2 days. Treatment doesn't have anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, certainly we cooperate with many, many facilities, but it was Memorial Day of 1997. Right before 6 o'clock, the treatment center person needed to go to dinner. They marched us around the corner to a discussion meeting in my city. I'm glad the meeting was there. It was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd had a court sheet, and it was so pretty with all the different colored ink, and I'd used every name from A to Z, and anything that was in squiggly writing in the book Alcoholics Anonymous as topics for my meetings. I mean, I was a whirlwind in AA. I spent the first 30 minutes of that meeting being personally offended that they were meeting on a federal holiday. Could not believe AA was meeting on a federal holiday. And then I did some simple math. It's much smaller now, but it was probably 50 people in that room that night. And I thought, my God, if every single one of these people talk, we're going to be here all night long. So at a breaking point, for them, not necessarily for me, they offered a silver chip, which in my part of the world indicates commitment, 24 hours of continuous sobriety. I didn't want your 24 hours of anything, but I thought, stop the madness, truthfully. And I went and got the chip, and all 50 people clapped. We said a prayer, and we closed that meeting, and in a minute after, the room was empty. Now, there are only a couple of things that I've learned in the short period of time I've been with you, but there are a couple of things that I take to the bank. There's a fundamental difference between a meeting house and a home group in Alcoholics Anonymous. There just is. It's taken me a long time in AA to understand that Alcoholics Anonymous needs both. And the second thing is, it is radically different to say, I'm going to AA, as opposed to, I'm in AA. Those just aren't the same thing either. Now, I was fortunate. A guy with 6 months of sobriety, which seemed like 1,000 years. Oh my gosh, 6 months, continuous, he said. It was like every day in a row. He came up to the new man. And, you know, I'm in a coat and tie because I think, you know, you need to not look like you've got a problem when you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. The treatment center and then Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And he's in drywall, covered in drywall, had about 25 earrings in the right ear and maybe 27 or 30 earrings in the left ear. He had tattoos started at the top of his neck, ran to the tips of his fingernails. I never could figure out how he got his fingertips tatted. He was a godsend to me. He looked me square in the eyes and he shook my hand and he said, "Welcome to AA. Welcome to AA. We are glad you are here." He gave me his telephone number. He tried his best to get mine. I was having none of that. He said, "If you'll be at this same meeting tomorrow night, I'll be here too." He didn't ask me if I was with the kids from the treatment center. Didn't ask me if I was coming to AA, if I was leaving AA. None of that stuff. I think our interchange maybe lasted all of 3 or 4 minutes. When I finally got sober and stayed sober, first 10, 12 years of my sobriety, you'd have 6 months of sobriety and reset, 8 months of sobriety and reset. It was just his path. He never sponsored me. He was really never a continual influence in my sobriety. But oh my gosh, what old Norm Alpa used to talk about, seconds and inches, that he was in that room at that particular moment that night. I went home and got drunk. Within 4 or 5 weeks, the treatment center sent me out to a book study on Thursday night. Not because the group was better, but because they studied the literature. And I met my first sponsor, the Larry Bird guy. From 6 to 7:45, he put a healing on me. He sat at a concrete picnic table at that church where the Big Book group of Alcoholics Anonymous had its meetings three nights a week. And I mean, I am telling you, he was on fire for this deal. Everything he talked about with a crescendo. It would just build. It would build and build and build. And, oh, we're on page such and such of the book, and it's that chapter, and you know what happens in that chapter. Oh, my God. It's so exciting, and maybe the chairperson will get there tonight. We're not sure. We think it might happen. Oh, we go to prison once a month. We go to prison. We leave at 4:30 on a Saturday morning. We go to the Montalba Cafe and have breakfast. Then we go over to the Tennessee Colony. You know the Tennessee Colony? There are 16,000 inmates at the Tennessee Colony. We're going to heal every one of those 16,000 inmates. So I went in and sat through the book study, and when I left, before my first day of continuous sobriety, I had my first job in AA, my first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I put the signs out at the Big Book group on Thursday night, signs in the yard at the church to let people know that AA met inside. And the Big Book group, we were a set-up-and-tear-down meeting back then, just like my home group, the Chicago group, is now. So many, many commitments in order to put Wednesday... We have Wednesday together and take it apart. We couldn't hang anything on the walls in the church, so they had had, I've heard this used a few times, this is a service assembly, of course, they had formed a subcommittee. They had formed a subcommittee to figure out the best way to handle the window shades, right? And they determined that they would frame them, and that's how we would bring them in and out of the room on Monday and Thursday and Saturday nights. We don't know a lot about moderation. And so the subcommittee had had them framed that was like double oak and bulletproof glass. And no kidding, they weighed 80 pounds apiece when they picked them up. And so we had to form a second subcommittee that was for the portability of said window shades. And they ultimately determined that we put dolly wheels on the back of them, so you wheeled them into the room. Now, it just looked like writing to me, right? This is just writing. So over the course of the summer, one time, I just wheeled them in. And I saw four or five people, been sober since the earth cooled, gather up at the back of the room. And like, here's our tables where we'd have the book study. It was about a small meeting, about 30, 35 people, and they wouldn't come in, right? They were like where the tripod is over there, and they wouldn't come in. And they were whispering at each other. I mean, they were obviously concerned. And I was just over here kind of looking or whatever, and then here's my sponsor, and they immediately, you know, have some caucus back there. And he comes up to me, and he takes the traditions from this side and moves them over here. And then takes the steps from this side and moves them over here, and then gives me like a 30-minute detailed analysis of why I need to pay attention that it says steps on the top of one of them and traditions on the top of the other one. And I'm like, these people are wound real tight. And I kept that commitment my first few months of sobriety, and so after I got sober and really became more and more actively engaged in Alcoholics Anonymous, full disclosure kind of forces me to tell you on two or three occasions, I mixed those up on purpose. Just to make sure that their, you know, blood pressure was good, right? It was the conscience of that group that if you lost your sobriety, you lost your commitment. I drank Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. All through the course of the summer of 97, I stayed sober on Thursday and showed up 30 minutes before the meeting started to put out the signs. We had four members of the steering committee. Every Thursday during the course of the summer went something eerily similar to this. One of the steering committee members would follow me to the closet where I'd get the signs for the yard. They'd walk out to the yard with me, so there were only two of us out in the yard when we had our conversation. They preserved my dignity. They said, Jimmy, we understand that you've lost your sobriety. It's the conscience of the group that we have to remove your commitment. Then it'd take them, I don't know, 15 or 20 seconds. They'd turn on their heel and they'd give the commitment back. It's a three legacy group of Alcoholics Anonymous. They absolutely believed in the tradition that said that the common welfare came first. My welfare did not. To them, I was the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was not the most important person in the room. We didn't have such a thing. But my sponsor, I'd found myself in a home group, and my sponsor was talking about his pigeon behind my back. And he said, I don't understand it, but the only sober breath that he ever draws is when he comes over here on Thursday to put out these signs. And they felt like they should encourage that to the extent that they could. Oh my God. I'm like a bunch of you. I've had a lot of jobs in AA. Lots of jobs in AA. Yeah. Interim chair of the General Service Board. Certainly an honor and a privilege. I mean, it was just a sequence of events that would not normally have ever happened. Southwest Regional Trustee for 4 years. Oh my gosh. Feel the weight of the fellowship. Feel the comfort of the weight of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. More email, more weight, more comfort, more letters, more passion, more involvement, more action. Oh my gosh. But in my first board meeting in 2019, July, Monday, that legal meeting that I described earlier at the workshop, first time in, I think about David A. I think about Dave Cook. God bless Dave Cook. He's my hero from your region, North Carolina, panel 17 delegate. I remember thinking, oh my gosh, right? Part of the record. Now, I'm not a big deal, but the job. I hit my button and I say, Jimmy Dean, Southwest Regional Trustee. When I turn that button off, I say, oh my gosh, what an honor and privilege to serve the fellowship at the bottom of the triangle. But really, it's a poor second to putting the signs out at the Big Book Group on Thursday night. They brought me into AA. By little and by slow, they judged the reaction of their prospect. They knew exactly what to do. They didn't mollycoddle me. They didn't babysit me. They told me I was dying of alcoholism, but they had a solution that they could absolutely agree on. They'd say, God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. On the night of the 24th of August, alcoholism drove me to my knees. And I got up that next morning after a full night of sleep, and I wanted what you had. And I was willing to do all those things that I thought were awfully superficial and stupid and had absolutely nothing to do with drinking. And I began to buy the package, right? I began to buy the package. What segment of Alcoholics Anonymous might I elect to leave out in my first 5 years of sobriety? In other words, what part will I give attention to and what part won't I? You know, will I take that inventory? Will I have deep conversations with that person that I know that I trust? Will I actually open up and tell deepest, darkest secrets? Will I be willing to hit my knees in the morning and ask God for a day of sobriety and hit my knees at night and thank God for that day? Am I willing to go see Cheryl Howe and sit there and be berated and abused at a registration table, right? Am I willing to give somebody $25 to register for a conference in Nowhere, Oklahoma? You're right, sight unseen. My sponsor would say, give me $25. And I'd go, why? Every time I give you money, we go somewhere bad. He said, it's not about the food and it's not about the arrangement, right? They'd say those things that were all riddles, right? Dinner's not about dinner, right? Dinner's not about dinner. It doesn't matter that there's no air conditioning and it's June in Western Oklahoma. I said, it matters. Why do we continue to have to prove ourselves that we're, I mean, this is like penance, torture. They had a little bit of the pecking order. I'm going to scare anybody. Not a lot of the pecking order. There are a couple of things. They said, you know, based on sobriety, you get in the front seat of the car or the back seat of the car. I get it. Based on sobriety, you either get a top bunk or a bottom bunk. And if you were new, you got a top bunk. Ha, 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 they thought, right? You have to climb up to the top bunk. Well, let me tell you, before they had air conditioning at the Canyon Conference, the only place a breeze might ever blow is during those little tiny windows in those stupid bunkhouses. And so I was up there, and I was relatively cool. And I thought, I don't ever want to have so much sobriety that I have to get down there. It's hot down there, right? I'd keep the secret to myself until I'd spot, you know, some sponsor brother or something that I thought really could get inside, handle inside information, right? And, of course, the first guy I tell, you know, he runs to tell our sponsor, Jimmy said it's a hell of a lot cooler up there on those top bunks, right? All right, I got to clean this up and get done. So early on, I called it windshield time, pavement time. Come early and stay late. That's the only way I've ever known how to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. You come early, and 30 or 45 minutes, you're doing some menial task, right? Whatever that commitment happens to be, and you're engaged in conversation with somebody else. And you'll tell stuff that you won't tell any other time. Washing dishes with another guy when you have a second Saturday breakfast at your sponsor's house. And he reveals things that he has not been prepared or willing to reveal until that particular point in time. I don't understand it. I think it's God's hand today, frankly, but I don't understand it. So I told that sponsor early on, long before I was ever really maybe 40 days in the program, 45 days in the program, after dinner on a Saturday night, I told him about the fact that I tried to strangle that grandmother with that cord that night and some of the other heinous things that I'd done in active alcoholism and how that relationship probably could never be repaired. And he said, tomorrow's Sunday. I want you to call her tomorrow. And you call her every Sunday until she tells you, do not call me again. And I got in the car and drove home, and I knew at 45 days I was done, right? Because I don't do that. I've been sober now for 45 days, and just like I'm circumventing this spiritual piece, I will also be able to, I'm a smart guy, right? I can circumvent those. That's for much, much later on. Years of sobriety, you address things like that, right? But I made a grave mistake. When I got home that night, I followed a pattern that I'd followed per my sponsor's instruction from all those days of sobriety. I hit my knees and thanked God for a day of sobriety. I got in the bed and I slept all night long. Next morning, I got up, and before I could catch myself, before I did anything else, I hit my knees and asked God for a day of sobriety that Sunday morning, and I couldn't think about anything but the phone. I made the call. I'm speaking in Area 16 because I made that call. There's no mistake. And that conversation was terse and short and without any emotion at all. And for the next 5 or 6 days, my sponsor listened to me whine and moan about the fact that that was not going to be effective, trying to describe personality and relationships and all this other kind of mess. He said, did she tell you not to call? And I said, no. And he said, next Sunday, put it on your calendar. Next Sunday, put it on your calendar. We talk about consistency and commitment all the time here. Since I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, make a commitment you don't get to decide. Jimmy, you're the guy who said you'd see us Saturday, but not which Saturday. Make the commitment, right? I'd been sober, I don't know, 140, 150 days. I was certainly still barely in the third step and probably hopping back to two fairly frequently. And at 11 o'clock on the Sunday morning, she answered the telephone per normal. And I was ready to follow the script that I'd been following that my sponsor gave me, which was about a minute long. I asked her how she was doing. I told her I was doing fine. But that morning, she surprised me when she answered the phone. I said, hello, and she said, I've been thinking about you today. I made a batch of tuna salad. From the time you were a little boy, you'd love my tuna salad. I have somewhere to be at 11:30, but if you can be in my house in the next 30 minutes, I'll make you a tuna salad sandwich. Not a big deal, right? I broke laws, ran red lights. Get down there. I ate that sandwich, and when she asked me a question, I said, yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am, as the case applied. 11:30, true to form, she kicked me to the curb. I didn't have a cell phone in 1998. I drove back out home, and the first person I called, of course, was Greg, my sponsor. He picked up the telephone, and I said, oh, my God, she's changed. He said, no, Jimmy, she hasn't changed, nor does she need to. You're beginning to change. It's a natural byproduct of beginning to apply the principles that are embodied in a program called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You cannot postpone or evade. These are the natural progressions of these principles. He believed that four things would appear in my life and become four assets of character on which I could always depend if I stayed close to you and did what you asked me to do. And those four things are accountability, availability, responsibility, and respectability. And I thank you very much for reinforcing those things, because when I'm the furthest away from those four vitally important principles, you are the closest. I don't understand that. And so I want to thank you, Area 16, for allowing me to spend this weekend with you and for your service to this fellowship that we know has saved all of our lives. Thanks.